with the paycheck plan. That's going so well. It's so smooth, so beautiful, almost without a hitch. All of that money is being distributed to small businesses. They're giving it to their employees. It's keeping them ready, viable, so when we open. And now it's been so good that it's almost depleted, and we want to replenish it, and we can't get the Democrats to approve it. And that's a program that they and everybody else admit that are great. So you do have partisanship.
President Trump speaking yesterday about how great the small business relief program is going. Well, was going. They announced today that that fund, totaling $350 billion, is now dry, out of money, and won't accept any new applications. Congress is deadlocked on plans to extend it, a program, by the way, that was plagued by problems since the get-go. Businesses who were approved for a loan, many still haven't seen any of that money. The delay is hitting businesses here in LA really hard, since many have been closed for almost a month because of stay-at-home orders. Joining me now to talk about this are two local business owners. Lawrence Ross is a co-owner of the Metaphor Club, a co-working space in Limerick Park. Hi, Lawrence.
Hello, how are you doing?
Good, thank you. And Alex Mislansky owns Stories Books and Cafe in Echo Park. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Madeline. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you both. Lawrence, let's begin with you. Tell me about the Metaphor Club and what it is and where you are right now with it.
So the Metaphor Club is a co-working community that we created in August of 2018. And I'm a writer, was looking for a creative space to write in, and then recognized that there was really no space like that in Limerick Park. After a lot of sweat and toil, we actually put it together, and we're one of the largest Black-owned creative co-working spaces in California.
So before this all happened, that long, long time ago, about a month, month and a half ago, what did it look like in your co-working space? How many people would be in there?
Oh, thriving. We're open from like 9 a.m. to 10 p.m., and we have people waiting in the parking lot to come in at 9 a.m., and they close us out at 10 p.m. So our people would come in, and there would be like shifts. The morning crew would come in, and then there would be like a mid-afternoon, and then the late night. So we'd have screenwriters would come in, folks studying for the MCAT. Other people are like entrepreneurs would be coming in. So it was very vivacious. And now what we find is that as we do various things like Zoom, you know, during the during this quarantine, is that, you know, they really miss that personal interaction and with people that they never knew before they came to the club.
Okay, Alex, over to you. A similar feeling drives people to your bookstore, right? People could order books online, but they don't. They go to your bookstore instead. Maybe hear authors, read, maybe meet other people, meet someone for a coffee. That's all gone, right?
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, we're like the sort of like the quintessential third place, you know, that's neither work nor home, but is the third place one can go to relax and be productive. So we're like Echo Park's default town square. It's always crowded and alive with energy people bring.
What kind of assistance is your business eligible for under this new relief effort?
Well, I applied for the PPP loan as soon as the portal opened for it.
That's the Paycheck Protection Program?
Yeah.
And that's the thing that lets you take out a loan and you can keep your employees on staff, right?
Ideally, yeah. I mean, that's the intent. And I'm still waiting on word as to when we'll get the money. I was hoping that we wouldn't have to miss a pay period for our employees. But I'm not sure that's going to be possible at this moment.
So you haven't gotten the money yet?
No, I actually spent an hour on hold with the bank in a futile attempt to check status on the application.
Does the bank know what's holding up the money? Because it comes from Treasury, right?
I was told it's a completely automated system, so there's no way for the individuals I've reached out to dig into that system to check status.
Wow, that's so frustrating. So meanwhile, how are you paying your employees?
Well, before things really took a turn towards the apocalyptic, I had gotten a cash loan from Square, so that gave us enough cash on hand to take care of all the imminent necessities like payroll and rent and some supplies. But that's not going to go much further without further assistance.
Like, so how much time do you think you have? until you really need more help?
That's the question. Not a lot. We're looking at weeks before the future we imagined is something completely different than what we had hoped.
Lawrence, did you also apply for a Paycheck Protection Program loan?
Yeah, the irony of how that system worked is that I have three other partners. And so basically, you know, we have some part-time folks that we, you know, that we hired, and we paid them out of our pocket all the way through the end of March. We actually closed a week before it was mandated because we just didn't feel it was ethical to be open, you know, during a pandemic, even if they hadn't given the order. So we paid it out of our pocket, and we went ahead and applied for PPP. The problem is that all four of us work the majority of the hours here. And so when we actually calculated what we were eligible for, it was like, you know, a pittance in terms of, you know, comparative, like what we don't get paid in terms of how we, you know, in terms of our sweat equity, I guess you would say. So it doesn't really hit on the mark for small businesses like ourselves, who are not necessarily paying ourselves and yet are putting, you know, 12 to 15 hours, you know, sometimes per day.
So if you guys manage to hold on, and I hope you do, what do you see as the future? We saw Governor Newsom's reopening ideas, and one of the ideas is that businesses will have to physically restructure. Like, Alex, what about your bookstore? You have small spaces in between the bookshelves. You've got a crowded cafe there. How do you plan on keeping people 6 feet apart if you do reopen?
I listened to Governor Newsom's strategy closely and tried to apply that to what the store would look like in that context. And it's hard to imagine that we'll be able to continue in the same spirit, with the same momentum, with the same resources we had before. It's going to be crippling in many ways.
Do you think that you might just transition to an online business?
I mean, that's not a reasonable option for us. I mean, we're a community space. Physical mm-hmm. bookstores, physical book selling is our reason to exist.
Yeah. And Lawrence, what about you? How would you reconfigure your space physically?
A number of things in terms of, for example, for our farmhouse tables, we've been looking into like those plastic barriers that you're starting to see. We're also trying to figure out in terms of the mandatory of masks. You know, for any business, particularly businesses that are based upon community, you're going to have to either let us know whether or not we can exist or whether or not we can't exist. You know, we look at it from the standpoint of saying there's really no hurdle we can't figure it out. The Metaphor Club in 2018, when we first got started, is going to be different from the one in 2020 when we get back going.
I applaud your optimism, and I hope both of you survive and thrive in the new world. Lawrence Ross is co-owner of the Metaphor Club. That's a co-working space in Limerick Park. And Alex Maslansky co-owns Stories Books and Cafe in Echo Park. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
Well, the government has hit its limit on the Small Business Relief Program. It's been riddled with problems since the very beginning. We're going to talk about that now with Holly Wade, Director of Research and Policy Analysis at the National Federation of Independent Business, which is a group that represents small businesses. Welcome, Holly.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, what has been the experience for most small business owners in trying to get these loans?
Well, we've heard from many small business owners across the country, and they are hugely frustrated with the rollout, the initial rollout. We certainly understand that there was huge demand and that the loan program had to be facilitated and up and running quickly. But on the small business owner end, you know, they are just looking for financial support as quickly as possible. And in accessing these loans, it has been less than ideal for many, and just also the complications of filling out the applications, getting the paperwork necessary, but also finding a participating bank to apply has been a challenge for many.
Right. So I've heard stories where banks just say, no, we are not going to do this. And it's the only bank in town and businesses are, they don't know what to do. They don't know where to go.
Exactly. I mean, if they don't currently bank with a participating lender in this program, they are effectively cut out of the system and have very little access to applying for these loans. So it was, you know, certainly helpful that more lenders were approved, even those non-traditional banks approved, like PayPal and Cabbage. So that certainly helped. But still, many small business owners are unable to find a bank to apply. But now with the funding having run out, it's impossible now for mm-hmm. small business owners who haven't already, you know, submitted their application to participate in the program.
So this was a $350 billion program. Presumably it went to some people because it's now out of money. How much more money is needed?
Well, there's certainly demand out there where small business owners haven't been able to apply. So I think there is significant demand. And also the demand will continue with, depending on the severity of the outbreak and the financial needs that are still to be met. So many small business owners have yet to apply, and you know, as quickly as they can appropriate money for these loans, the better, so we can help more small businesses through this crisis.
And who gets the loans? Is it really first come, first served?
Yes, it was first come, first served. So there were small business owners in the line the day that the window for employers opened up, April 3rd. And then on April 10th, independent contractors and the self-employed were able to apply. However, there was little guidance available for banks to facilitate those loans. So there were millions and millions more small business owners who are non-employers that were left out of the loan program and still have yet to apply and get that financial support that they desperately need.
So these are people who don't have employees but have business expenses.
Yes, correct. So accountants and plumbers, electricians, mm-hmm. Actors, there's so many who don't have employees, but they have real business expenses and also, you know, their lost net earnings. So, you know, to help them continue and remain solvent through this crisis so that they too can get to the other side and continue to pay those bills that will continue to come throughout.
So we heard President Trump earlier complain about inaction in Congress. What is the sticking point here in terms of extending this program?
I mean, it sounds like it's, you know, the opportunity to add more to the legislation. Our focus, our primary focus, is funding these important programs. There are only two programs that are targeted to small business owners and who are our members, NFIB members, and those are the Payment Protection Program, the PPP Loan Program, and the economic injury disaster loans that are facilitated through the SBA. And both programs have run out of money. So there are, you know, virtually no more options available to small business owners to get that financial help that they need.
I've seen a figure that if nothing is done, 3.5 million small businesses will go out of business permanently in the next 2 months. Is that what you're seeing?
Yes, I mean, that sounds about right, in that a huge population of small business owners are likely to have to close their business if they don't get help very soon. When we surveyed a sample of our members a few weeks ago, about 50% of them said that given economic conditions at the time, which have deteriorated since then, that they would not be able to keep their doors open any longer than 2 months. So time is of the essence for these business owners. They're looking for immediate help, and so we're looking to Congress to help fund those programs as soon as possible.
Holly Wade is Director of Research and Policy Analysis at the National Federation of Independent Business. Holly, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, shelter in place versus reopening, how that has become a political issue, especially in some rural states. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. President Trump is trying to rally support to reopen the country sooner rather than later. And some of his supporters want their local lawmakers to follow suit and lift local stay-at-home orders. Yesterday in Lansing, Michigan, the state capital, hundreds of cars clogged the streets in what was called Operation Gridlock. That, in defiance of stay-at-home orders and social distancing guidelines put in place by Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer. Similar protests have occurred in other states. In Ohio, earlier this week, at least 100 people gathered outside the state house in Columbus. Not in cars, or staying 6 feet apart, or wearing masks. Here to talk about this is Ed Kilgore, political columnist at New York Magazine. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great. So how many protests have there been, and are they linked?
Well, I can't personally keep count of all of them. There have been very notable ones, as you mentioned, in Michigan, in Ohio, in Kentucky. These were all at state capitals. There have been sort of acts of civil disobedience in Idaho, and a lot of scattered protests everywhere. And yes, best we could tell, they are being at least loosely coordinated. In fact, Politico reported that there's a coalition of conservative groups, including some pretty well-known names like the Tea Party Patriots and the Koch Network, that are actively holding discussions on how to push back against any kind of coronavirus lockdown, and essentially turn this into a national movement. And if you look at these individual protests, there are a lot of very familiar faces, and they tend to be very self-conscious conservative ideologues, a lot of Trump signs and MAGA hats and sort of Tea Party-ish reminiscent regalia. And a lot of the message is the same, that it's, big government taking advantage of the coronavirus to crush liberties, blah, blah, blah.
Right. Well, so help me understand this a little bit, because especially in Michigan, the outbreak is pretty severe there. Are people right. saying that they don't believe that the outbreak is severe? Are they saying that social distancing doesn't work? Are they saying it's not worth the trade-off, losing businesses and paychecks in exchange? What is their general concern?
Well, I would say that most of them do not perceive themselves as threatened by the coronavirus personally. They're not from the urban cores where the outbreaks are the worst. However, they're being affected by the economic ramifications of lockdowns. There's a sort of a strong undercurrent of religious liberty arguments. A lot of them are angry that they couldn't have traditional church services. And there's, without too much question, still a bit of denialism going on. People who sort of agreed with the president when he downplayed the coronavirus to begin with, and now they want to get past this and get back to normal as quickly as possible. So it's a real mixture of motives, and it may vary a little bit from place to place. But again, the common theme seems to be big government is taking advantage of this terrible thing and crushing our liberties. And we need to get that over with as quickly as possible and let us decide how to protect ourselves or to protect our health. Of course, the problem being that you can't really get rid of these lockdowns and without other people's health and safety being affected if these people are wrong and there's a brand new outbreak mm-hmm. because social distancing breaks down.
Right. And so I guess I'm wondering, when it comes to protests and you see these, you see a lot of these people not maintaining social distancing or wearing masks or any of that, whether there can be an outbreak that comes because of the protests.
Right. And certainly if the protests become you know, turns into active civil disobedience. I mean, it's kind of alarming to me that they're in Kentucky, at least, you saw conservative state legislators sort of identifying themselves with this group. There have been some, I know, conservative legislators in Michigan that have sort of joined these protests, and also in Idaho. If this continues to spread, then you could see open defiance, kind of a blue state, red state dynamic taking over. And again, probably the key factor in all of this is whether Donald Trump begins to sympathize with these protesters. And, you know, there are a million reports today that he really, really, really wants to get through this and reopen the economy. And there's an endless sort of tug of war going on within the administration over how long to continue these measures, most of which are, you know, following Trump administration guidelines.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so how is it that on the one hand you have one strain of his administration and you report on one person in particular, Stephen Moore, who has advised the president on tax policy, advocating
his chief
a quick reopening.
Advisor.
Yeah. And so he's advocating a quick reopening. On the other hand, then you have other members of the administration saying we need to keep this in place. And so how do these two sides of the administration square that? Or don't they?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm not an expert on the internal workings of this very strange White House and this very strange administration. I mean, to some extent, until recently, the political advisors to the president have been siding with the public health officials like Dr. Fauci. If that begins to flip, or if the political advisors begin to split, you know, it could go the other way pretty quickly. I'm sure the president, you know, is watching Fox News and looks out at these protesters and sees his people. And, you know, I've joked today that, you know, he might do a Air Force One flyover over one of these protests. But joking aside, it's a very grave moment in terms of the administration's own positioning. If the president really wants to reopen the economy too quickly, and if there's now a mass protest movement backing him up. As far as the Republican Party, let's don't forget that the Tea Party movement, which this looks a lot like, initially attacked Republicans as well as Democrats, you know, establishment members, and eventually sort of took over the Republican Party. So you could see this sort of movement really, excuse the expression, infecting, you know, the GOP and, mm-hmm. and turning this into much more a partisan battle than we've seen up until now.
Ed Kilgore is political columnist at New York Magazine. Thanks, Ed.
Thank you.
While President Trump tries to rally support for plans to reopen the government next month, some of the states he points to as success stories are now seeing a spike in cases. States like Iowa, North and South Dakota, Nebraska. As of now, none of these states has a statewide stay-at-home order. And the disease could be more deadly there in those states because rural states have fewer doctors and hospitals, and many people don't have easy access to health care. Alice Miranda Olstein is a healthcare reporter for Politico, and she's been following the surge in rural America. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So what does this surge look like?
So some of the states that don't have a stay-at-home order, we're sort of referring to them as holdout states because the vast majority of the country does have such an order in place. But these states, which are mainly redder, more rural, sparsely populated, they have resisted taking this step. Some of these states, including Nebraska, South Dakota, and Iowa, have seen major spikes in recent days. And you have mayors who are seeing this devastation and seeing the cases growing, asking their governors to please issue a stay-at-home order, and the governors are not supportive of that step. And this is all coming as President Trump and some of his top health officials have pointed to these states as examples of leading the rest of the country out of lockdown, saying that some of these states have really good testing and contact tracing systems in place to control outbreaks. But this is showing that might not be safe at this point.
Can you talk about South Dakota in particular? Because there's a conflict between the mayor of Sioux Falls and the governor there, the mayor asking for a stay-at-home order after a big outbreak at a pork processing plant there. And the governor, well, she's just refusing to issue a stay-at-home order, basically saying the outbreak would not have been prevented by a stay-at-home order because this is an essential business. Can you talk about the tension there between the mayor and the governor and this stay-at-home controversy?
Absolutely. And it's a pattern we're seeing in other states as well that we've reported on. But the governor is right in some senses because these kind of core parts of our food system are designated essential. And so even if a state does have a stay-at-home order, those workers were still going into work. Now, on the other hand, a stay-at-home order just limits the rest of society's interactions and controls the spread of the virus. So even if you have people going into work, they're going home, they're around their families. If their families are still going out shopping, for example, or going out in public spaces because there's no stay-at-home order, that furthers the spread of the virus. And so you have mayors, local lawmakers saying, we really want this stay-at-home order to control people's movements and to limit the spread of the virus. You have governors saying, no, that's not necessary. It would cause too much economic devastation, et cetera.
And is it accurate to say that more than 600 cases of COVID-19 can be traced back to that Smithfield pork plant in Sioux Falls?
Yeah, it's become one of the biggest hotspots in the entire country, yes. And it's really been a sort of warning for other states. North Dakota has seen far fewer cases, and their deaths are only in the single digits. They've really had very low numbers so far. But the governor said yesterday when he announced that he was extending, he doesn't have a stay-at-home order, but he has other restrictions in place, he was extending them for the next 10 days. And one of the things he said, which I found really interesting, is he was referring to the pork plant in South Dakota, and he said, our Smithfield may be ahead of us. So basically, even the states that don't have stay-at-home orders say, look, we are seeing what is happening, and we think it's too soon to fully go back to normal, even as the president is pushing for that.
So this is, as you're describing it, this has a political shadow over it, that these are conservative states, by and large, rural populations who maybe support President Trump. So what are the politics of this, of stay-at-home, of resisting stay-at-home, statewide stay-at-home orders?
It's really mixed because, like I said, almost the entire country, except for this handful of states, does have a stay-at-home order, and that includes many very conservative Republican-controlled states. However, you have seen in those states conservative residents protesting in recent days, putting pressure on their state governments to lift these restrictions, saying it's gone on long enough, it's causing economic pain, et cetera. You have governors caught between various forces and various pressures. They're hearing from public health officials that it is far too risky to lift restrictions now, that even though we are seeing in some places a flattening of the curve, to celebrate and go back to normal would cause a surge in cases. And on the other hand, you have pressure from the president who is saying this has gone on long enough, we need to get the country back to work. So governors are in a very tough position. They were the ones to issue these restrictions in the first place. And no matter what the president says about him having total authority, it will be the governors who make the decisions of when to send people back to work.
And what are the models for rural states? We have models here. We check them every day to see when we expect the peak to happen, how many hospital beds will be needed, et cetera. What are the models now for these rural states in terms of how bad the outbreak will be?
Well, the models get updated all of the time. And so just in the last few days, you saw cases spiking in some of these states we're talking about. And so they've had to adjust their models. It just changes every day based on people's behavior. You know, models are not a crystal ball. They are making assumptions about how well people abide by these voluntary guidelines, how well people put on masks and stay at home, et cetera. And whether or not people's behavior bears that out impacts where it's going. And so, for instance, Arkansas is another one. They're saying we have adequate hospital capacity. They're not being overwhelmed like in New York and other places. We feel good right now. However, it's too early to tell where this could go in the future.
And without a stay-at-home order in place, we have seen in other places that the numbers can spike pretty quickly.
Absolutely. And local officials who are asking their states to put these orders in place make that point and say that it's really about sending a message to residents that this is something they should take seriously. I talked to a local official in Arkansas this week who said that the university near him was still having frat parties, and he doesn't know if a stay-at-home order would necessarily discourage that, but he thinks that the lack of one does send a message, and people may throw caution to the wind.
Alice Miranda Olstein is a healthcare reporter for Politico. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, well, a lot of us have been eating a lot as we hunker down. Good Foods' Evan Kleiman is here with her weekly recipe. Today, it's hummus.
And it's so easy. This one, even easier because it's not pureed. It's a whole garbanzo bean hummus.
Cooking with Evan next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand, and let's admit it, we all may be eating a lot and a lot of food that's not particularly good for us as we're under quarantine. Evan Kleiman is here now with a healthy alternative. Hi, Evan.
Hi, Madeline.
All right, you have brought this week a recipe for hummus, which is delicious. It's not necessarily low-cal, but it is healthy, right?
It's delicious and it's very healthy and it, you know, it's protein in a different form. So, you know, so many of us have gotten used to buying industrial hummus that we have forgotten how absolutely luscious homemade hummus is, and it's so easy. This one, even easier because it's not pureed. It's a whole garbanzo bean hummus.
What? I've never heard of such a thing.
Well, it's very traditional throughout the Middle East. Sami Tamimi, who is Yotam Ottolenghi's business partner in the restaurant business, has come out with a new book called Falestine. And in this book, there is a wonderful recipe for what is called musabaha. And musabaha is chickpeas that you have cooked from scratch, but you can use canned chickpeas. They're warm. So if you're using canned chickpeas, you would put the whole can into a little saute pan, a saucepan. You would heat it up. Then you make a tahini mixture, and you pour it over these whole warm garbanzo beans. Let that heat up a little bit. And then you just add a little bit of spice and other delicious ingredients, and you end up with this absolutely rustic, irresistible dish.
Mm, that sounds delicious. How do you make the tahini mixture?
You can use just straight tahini that you've thinned with a little bit of water. Mm-hmm. Cold water is the secret. Whenever you're mixing tahini, it's kind of a strange experience because you first add your ice cold water and it seizes up and you think, oh my goodness, I've made a terrible mistake. But then you keep adding a little bit more ice water by the tablespoon and you keep stirring your tahini, and then it turns into just this beautiful smooth thing. You can add some garlic to that. You can add some lemon juice, or you can keep it plain and then you just pour it over. But we'll have Sammy's recipe to share with everyone. This is the one frustration I have about our situation right now, is so many authors that I normally would be interviewing, I'm not. And this is a way for me to share with you, not just my recipes, but recipes from books that you can still get online that are new and have wonderful stories.
So the book is called Falestine, and you can get it anywhere? You can,
yes,
order it online?
You can order it online. One of the beauties of this particular dish is that Sammy and Tara suggest that you make this green chili sauce that is just so delicious, and it's used as a like a condiment garnish in the musabaha. It's so good.
And what's in it? What's in the green chili sauce?
It's a green chili, like a jalapeno or a serrano, mm-hmm, lemon juice, white wine vinegar, crushed garlic, salt, and parsley.
And so what does the finished product look like?
It looks like white and creamy chickpea soup, but not that liquidy. I'm making it sound so ugly, but it's actually really appealing in a very Odelangi, Middle Eastern, rustic way. And then you serve it either with fresh pita or pita chips. Delish.
Yeah, that sounds absolutely delish. And it does sound like it could make a whole meal.
Oh, yeah. Especially, and often musabaha is, if you want, you can serve it with a hard-boiled egg. And if you make that egg not too hard-boiled, so it's a little jammy, even better.
Mm. Well,
Paco's getting hungry.
I hear Paco there snorting away. Is he asleep or is he salivating? What's happening?
He's sitting and staring at me from across the room.
Okay. Longingly, wanting some musabaha. All right. I'll let you go and feed him and feed yourself. Thank you, Evan.
Thank you so much.
That's Evan Kleiman, host of KCRW's Good Food. Coming up, we'll have your Friday film reviews today on Thursday because who knows what day it is anymore these days. And why not? Dave White and Alonzo Duralde are here next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. We have a special episode of the show planned for tomorrow. So today we're going to do our regular Friday feature, movie reviews. Joining me now are Alonzo Duralde and Dave White, film critics and hosts of the podcast Linoleum Knife. Hello.
Hello.
Howdy.
Are you enjoying your quarantine?
No.
Enjoy might be putting too fine a point on it, but, you know, like the Surviving. Dude, we abide.
Okay. All right. Well, let's begin with one movie we may or may not abide, and that is The Quarry. It's a thriller starring Michael Shannon. Here's a clip.
I'm looking for the church.
You just passing through, I guess?
Here to work.
You ever live in a town like this? Everybody knows everybody, and people think it's quaint.
We are made right with God through faith in Jesus, not by obeying the law.
Okay, Alonzo, what is this movie about?
So Shea Whigham is a drifter. He is picked up literally on the side of the road by a would-be Good Samaritan. And of course, then Shea Whigham winds up, oops, murdering him. But then he also decides to take over his identity, which is this guy was headed to this small town to become the new preacher in a church. Maybe priest. I mean, like, there's an implication that it's Catholicism, but no one really ever says for sure.
Yeah, there's a robe and a thing around the neck, and you're like, oh, so it's a Catholic church?
Yeah,
and then no one ever explains what kind of church it is at all.
Who knows? Anyway, so the local lawman is played by Michael Shannon. There is the discovery of the body, and Shannon tries to pin it on these two local sort of like low-level weed dealers who are related to Catalina Sandina Moreno, who is the Wiggum's new landlady and Shannon's love interest. So it all becomes this sort of morality play of, is Wiggum going to step up and confess? Is he going to let these innocent Hispanic kids get railroaded for the crime he committed? And this would seem interesting on paper, but it doesn't really hold together, starting with the fact that there's no real reason for Wiggum to take over this guy's identity. Like, he's just begging to get caught, basically.
Well, that's part of the narrative. Like, he is begging to get caught. He is trying to get some redemption for the evil that he has done in his life. And he thinks by stepping into this identity that he can, you know, manufacture some of that. Unfortunately, for this small town, you know, Southern Gothic sort of story, the ghost of Flannery O'Connor is hovering all around it saying, what the hell are y'all doing? Because this is a heavy-handed metaphorical story about identity and forgiveness and, you know, fear and violence, and it's been done a lot.
Yeah, I mean, the basic plot setup is right out of, you know, if you watch Banshee on Cinemax, or if you saw the Polish Oscar-nominated best foreign film Corpus Christi, the notion of, you know, an outsider stepping into a community, you know, in somebody else's identity and, you know, undergoing a change. And it's certainly great to see Shea Whigham in a lead role. He's a really talented character actor. You probably saw him in Joker recently.
And Michael Shannon delivers, as usual,
always, a
terrific performance.
Yeah, Sandina Moreno.
His sheriff is sort of bored and irritated and sort of contemptuous of the town that he's in. He describes, you know, the allure of small town life as though it were a thing from the past. So he's sort of hovering around his own domain like a ghost. And I know I just said the ghost of Flannery O'Connor is hovering around it too, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. There are a lot of ghosts, and maybe they should have remained buried, is what you're saying.
Yeah, you know.
We are bored, but we're not that bored, is what you're saying. Okay, well, speaking of, let's move on to something else. A documentary called The Booksellers. It's about the world of rare book dealers and how they plan to survive the internet. Here's a clip.
One of the things I remember about those guys, they were very irritated if you wanted to buy a book. They were there so they could read all day.
Collecting is about the hunt. The internet has killed the hunt.
What the internet did was change the way we talked about what was rare. For a lot of dealers, it was devastating, and it destroyed their livelihood.
All right, Dave, don't we know this story already?
Well, you know, if you've been in a bookstore in the past 20 years, yeah, you know this story. It's because the bookstore you went into probably closed. This is from director D.W. Young. You heard Fran Lebowitz in there giving all the cool quotes that Fran Lebowitz always gives for subject matter like this. It's a film produced by Parker Posey, who narrates a little bit, and it covers the waterfront on rare book and used book dealers, from antiquarian dealers to people who specialize in less, you know, rarefied stuff, just regular old used booksellers, people who specialize in bookbinding, contemporary archivists, you know, of internet era journals and zines, everybody. The range is wide. But there is an emphasis in the film on the ticking clock of both dealers and customers who are aging out of selling and buying. The book sales of across the board, you know, new and, you know, people who run specialized used bookstores, they're going down all the time.
Yeah.
And that's troubling.
Well, now more than ever, right? Because who's going to a bookstore now? They're all closed for the time
being. Well, they're all, yeah, sure. They are currently, yes. And this is a wonderful, you know, snapshot of a business and where it is right now, and possibly fearfully where it might be in 20 years. One of its most welcome qualities is that it is not precious. Only once or twice do you hear any interviewee sort of rhapsodize about the book itself as an object, you know, that sort of books are magic sort of thing that you hear people talk about from time to time. I'm reminded of a narrative film that Alonzo and I talked about not so long ago on this very show, Madeline Brand. It was called The Bookshop. It was a narrative feature. It was so twee, and it definitely trafficked in that NPR-based cliche about people who obsess about books just for their own sake as sort of a mark of a cozy intellectual life. This is not that. This is much more, you know, on the ground, real people stuff.
And it's the kind of movie that has a lot of ground to cover, so it'll sort of veer off occasionally into these side things about, like, book preservation or the notion of bibliophilia or, you know, kind of the history of the printed word even. But it always gets back to this sort of core group of these, you know, you've got the older booksellers in New York who've managed to hang on, whether they own the building or for whatever other reason. And then also this new generation. I think this movie is a little hopeful because you do get to see these millennials who are starting to open these new shops in New York. And there's kind of this new wave of interest in tangible physical media in the same way that, you know, these are the people who championed the vinyl album and, you know, even the VCR and the video cassette. You know,
the Los Angeles version of this would be Ooga Booga, which was in Chinatown for a very long time and recently sadly closed. Family Bookstore on Fairfax. Shops like that where...
Or the Last Bookstore downtown.
Or the Absolutely, Last, which is on a much grander scale, the Last Bookstore downtown. But like the idea of, you know, young people opening bookstores because they really need to do that.
Okay. Speaking of books, the Netflix documentary Circus of Books is out on Wednesday. Not really about books. It's about porn. Here's a little from the trailer.
I'm Karen.
I'm Barry. And we own Circus of Books.
I thought it was just a bookstore with a circus theme.
Circus of Books was the center of the gay universe.
Just like porn, P-O-R-N.
If anyone asked us what our parents did, the official answer was,
we own a bookstore.
Okay, so Circus of Books opened in 1960 in West Hollywood, and then it had branched out to several locations. All of them no longer with us, right? They're all closed?
That's correct.
That is true.
So, Alonzo, tell us about when this chain was open and the impact it had.
Well, you know, this is a portrait of Karen and Barry Mason, who are the parents of the director, Rachel Mason, who's kind of telling this extraordinary story. In 1976, they were able to sort of buy into Book Circus, a failing bookstore that was in arrears on all of its, you know, various payments. And they figured the cheapest way to rename the store would be to cut it in half, you know, jiggle the words around and put an "of" in there. So Circus of Books was born. And, you know, it winds up becoming in the 1980s this sort of ad hoc, you know, gay community center. It becomes a gathering place, for people to get information, to meet each other, certainly. And then as the AIDS pandemic starts to grow, it becomes a place where people can get information, can pick up some free condoms. So with Circus of Books, yes, you know, people were going there to buy adult magazines and video cassettes or whatever they were selling. But it also became this community center for the LGBT community in Los Angeles. This is an interesting parallel because Booksellers is so very New York, and Circus of Books, I think, is so very Los Angeles.
Yeah. Did you guys used to go there? Just not to put you on the spot.
The West Hollywood location is around the corner from us. And, you know, while obviously we knew what their main stock in trade was, that's where we would go to buy, like, Sight and Sound and, you know, Art Forum. They had a really good, like, you know, mainstream magazine.
I'm sure that's all you were buying. Yeah.
Okay. No, I mean, the funny thing is that one of the things that they don't stress very much in the film, they do cover it a little bit, is that in addition to, you know, this huge, you know, amount of porn that was, you know, separated from the rest of the stock by this little swinging door. They had a really great international newsstand, and you could get kind of any magazine from any part of the world. And that was such a cool thing to have in our neighborhood, that if we wanted Film Comment, if we wanted Sight and Sound, you know, I mean, we're film critics, you know, we wanted to go down there and look for the stuff that we couldn't get. And so that was such a big loss. And so that was really, you know, in addition to this being a story about a family who were a little, you know, sheepish about how they made their living.
You think of pornographers, that is not these folks.
It's also very indirectly a film about the death of bookstores, which connects it to the Booksellers. Mm-hmm. And about, specifically in Los Angeles, about the death of brick and mortar businesses all over West Hollywood right now, mm-hmm. particularly that stretch, that very specific stretch of Santa Monica Boulevard where Circus of Books was, that has been decimated.
Well, I will say the Circus of Books in my neighborhood is now a weed store. So there's the sign of the times.
And you know, porn maven Shishi LaRue has taken over the circus space and is turning that into an expansion of that particular retail empire. So once those doors are open again, I think you'll be seeing something akin to what the old Circus of Books carried, except I don't think that he's going to have Sight and Sound and Art Forum. but, you know, that was actually a valid business model for a long time.
So aside from that, I mean, fascinating, all the issues that you raise, is it a good movie? Is it entertaining? Is it worth watching?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, it's such a great family story. I mean, it's that thing of getting your parents to sit down and talk about all the stuff that they had to go through. You know, the director's brother comes out as gay, and, you know, that actually causes more of a ripple in the family than you would imagine, given the business that they were in and who their clientele were. But, you know, that ends happily as well. There's a lot of, you know, it's an intersection of a lot of different interesting stories.
It is a scruffy homemade kind of documentary, but it's a fascinating subject. It's lovingly made, and it's a document about Los Angeles that I think is important, particularly for people who live here to see. You know, it's this historical document.
Okay, and it's available for streaming on Netflix, right?
Beginning on Wednesday the 22nd.
Okay. Well, thanks, you guys.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
That's Dave White, Alonzo Duralde, film critics and hosts of the podcast Linoleum Knife. And that's it for us here at Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.